Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 458, an interview with Lucy Commissar about offshore banking. This is being recorded on May 2nd of the year 2004. It's my pleasure once again to present to the audience Lucy Commissar, an investigative journalist with whom we visited before. Lucy, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, you have an article in a new publication called Hound Dogs, an investigative zine that we'll be talking about toward the end of this side, and it's called A Threat, Offshore Banking, A Threat to America. Why do you characterize the issue of offshore banking as a threat to America?
Because it's the international financial services system for criminals and for terrorists. Among the criminals are drug traffickers. Also among the criminals are people like the guys who ran Enron, who have very seriously threatened the livelihoods of many Americans. It's the way that all kinds of crooks and criminals move their money. It's the way that Saddam Hussein moved his money and hid his rake-offs and bought arms when it was when there was an embargo on. So that's why it's a threat to America and also to other countries in the world.
One of the major focal points of your Hound Dogs article is the Clearstream Network. This is something that we've spoken about before, specifically for listeners who would like to access the archives. We spoke about this in For the Record Program Number 387, a previous interview with Lucy Commissar. Clearstream is described as a clearinghouse. Could you tell us, what is a clearinghouse? How does it work? This is an institution that is likely to be strange to many of our listeners.
Well, if you live in a city in the U.S. and you want to buy a stock that's on the London Stock Exchange, you go to your banker who has an account in Clearstream. Clearstream is a house of compensation or clearinghouse for financial paper, meaning stocks and bonds. And you put in your order, and you get the stock. But money does not really travel. The value goes to the bank that is representing the company or the individual from whom you bought the stock. And so they credit and debit different accounts. The next day, maybe the purchase will go in the other direction, and the bank that had the debit will instead have a credit. And rather than moving money back and forth, they just debit and credit people's accounts. Now, for just moving cash around the world or around the country, they use SWIFT. But for using financial paper, they use Clearstream, which is based in Luxembourg, and they use Euroclear, which is based in Brussels.
Both of those, I believe, at this point are now owned by the Deutsche Börse, aren't they, the German
stock
exchange?
The Deutsche Börse, the German... stock exchange owns the Clearstream.
I thought they had bought Euroclear. I'm
not
sure.
If
this
they
is
did,
tangential.
I didn't know about that. Yeah. I didn't know that they had also bought Euroclear.
We'll put a question mark by that, and I'll double check that on the internet. And if in fact that's the case, I'll indicate that in the description for this interview. Now, one of the phenomena upon which Clearstream was predicated, one of the things that helped to produce its genesis, is something called Eurodollars. I wonder if you could tell us what Eurodollars are, and what is the relationship between the Eurodollar phenomenon and the genesis of Clearstream or Sedell Clearstream?
Well, Sedell is what Clearstream used to be called before 1990, but both Sedell and Euroclear were started to manage the transfers of Eurodollars. And Eurodollars are U.S. currencies kept in banks outside the United States. They were invented by the Chinese and the Soviets in the 50s because they didn't want to have to put their dollar assets in banks in the U.S. because they were afraid the U.S. government would seize them. But after the Eurodollars were invented, which basically, you know, a dollar is just a promise to pay, and a Eurodollar was a promise to pay that amount in dollars, they began to be traded for other currencies. And some banks wanted them and paid higher interest than the interest that was being paid in the United States. So then U.S. corporations and individuals began to use these accounts in countries outside the U.S. to avoid laws that control domestic banks and what domestic banks can do. So the Euro money market was born. And by now, about two-thirds of U.S. currency is held abroad in euro dollars.
If you just joined us, we're visiting with Lucy Commissar, investigative journalist and author of Offshore Banking, A Threat to America, in the newly created Hound Dogs investigative publication. Now, Lucy, the Clearstream phenomenon involves, the Clearstream institution, I should say, involves published and unpublished accounts, and much of the controversy and apparently a fair amount of the commerce that has taken place through Clearstream revolves around these published or unpublished accounts. Could you distinguish between the two, and what is the significance of being published versus unpublished, and sort of explain the controversy vis-a-vis these unpublished accounts?
Yeah. As Clearstream, say Dell, and then Clearstream developed, it was used not just for trading in euro dollars, but also for trading or moving stocks and financial paper. And at a certain point in the early 90s, it was taken over, or the head of it, the CEO, became a man named Andre Lucy. Now, they had some years before some German and Italian banks, just for bookkeeping purposes, not want the credit and the debit going to each of their subsidiary banks. That is, if some small Italian bank in some city was doing this trading, its headquarters bank, maybe it was in Rome or Milan, didn't want the movement directly to that bank. It wanted everything to go through the main bank. And so they started a system of non-published accounts, that is, of the published number. Each bank had a number, and and there would be a directory of numbers. So if you wanted to send, it's like the SWIFT number, you know, on your check, your personal check, the number on the right side is your account number. The number on the left side is the SWIFT number, which is the number of the bank, and if there is money being sent from one bank to another, because somebody has deposited a check in their bank, but the money is going to be paid by your bank, they have to move it according to the SWIFT number, and that's that number. Now, using the numbers in said Dell Clearstream, they also had numbers, but instead of just having a number for the bank, these banks, a few of Italian and German banks, didn't want all their subsidiaries to have different numbers. They thought it would be confusing bookkeeping. So that there would be some non-published numbers. The subsidiary banks would have non-published numbers, and the money would go through the main branch, and then it would move to the subsidiary branch, but everything would have gone through the main branch. But the idea is that the non-published numbers would only be given to the subsidiaries. Well, when this man, Andre Lucy, came on, all of a sudden, they began giving numbers to banks that were not subsidiaries of other banks. And in cases where the purpose was not helping bookkeeping problems. And it turned out, after a while, that half of the accounts, there were maybe, 5 or 6,000 accounts, half of them got to be non-published accounts. And that meant that when law enforcement authorities or anybody doing investigation went to look at the accounts in Luxembourg at the headquarters to see what, because everything has gone through the Luxembourg headquarters, they would only see the published accounts. They would not see the non-published account. So that in 1995, for example, Sedell had more than 2,200 published accounts, but it altogether had 4,200 accounts. That means 2,000 of them were non-published. And it's very interesting to see that the banks with the most non-published accounts by the year 2000, for example, when there were 15,000 accounts and half were non-published, the banks with most non-published accounts were the Banque Internationale de Luxembourg, which had 309 and which has been involved in a lot of very questionable money laundering scandals, Citibank, which had 271, and Barclays Bank, which had 200. Now, besides that, there were banks that had non-published accounts that had no connection to a regular bank. For example, on the 2000, the year 2000 list, there were 37 accounts of only of which only three were published. And these non-published accounts were separate banks. They were not subsidiaries of the three published accounts. The Russians also had many non-published accounts, and again, they were not subsidiaries of published accounts. They were out there by themselves, or I should say hidden all by themselves.
So, in other words, basically, these unpublished accounts are a vehicle for a huge amount of international commerce to basically take place beneath the radar screen of not only regulatory agencies, but law enforcement agencies.
That's right. That's right.
Now, one of the things...
May I add
sure.
that this was exposed in a book called Revelation by a man named Ernest Bacchus, and just some months ago, Andre Luci, the man who I mentioned... The CEO,
by the way,
Lucy, fired after the book was published, he has been indicted.
By the way, let me interrupt. That's spelled, for people who would like to look that up, L-U-S-S-I is the spelling of Mr. Lucy's last name. Actually, you anticipated my next question, Lucy. A fair amount of your article focuses on someone whom I think it would be accurate to describe as a genuine modern-day hero, and that is the gentleman you mentioned, Ernest Bacchus. Could you tell us about Ernest Bacchus's historical role in helping to develop what became Clearstream? What contributions he made to the development of this network? How did he ultimately run afoul of the powers that be in Clearstream? And tell us, you mentioned his book Revelation, and if you could tell us some of the waves, I guess, that the shock waves that spread from the publication of that book, because they were considerable.
Yes, Ernest Bacchus had worked for this company in the 80s, and actually helped set up the computer system. And then around 1983, he was fired. And he was told that it had to do with how he had dealt with some banker, and this important banker had been upset with him. But he said later that he thinks there was really another reason, but he didn't know it at the time. He was aware of money movements that were going on that were... from the Banco Ambrosiano in Italy. And this is the bank that became known as the Vatican Bank, and which collapsed not long after that. The head of the Banco Ambrosiano, whose name was Roberto Calvi, was found hanging from Blackfriars Bridge in London. At that time, it was declared it was a suicide. Recently, in the last year or so, the Italian police have found new evidence, have opened up the case, and they say now that it was murder. There are all kinds of stories about it, that it might have been the mafia. He was also very close to the Vatican. There were lots of funny things going on, but what Ernest Bacchus saw was that money was going to offshore places, and really what it was money that was disappearing out of the bank, and that's why the bank collapsed. And he thinks that's why he was moved out. Another thing that happened is another official of the bank who had been opposed to giving these non-published accounts to banks that didn't want it. He was a man in early middle age, in very good health. He went to on vacation, and suddenly he died. He had a heart attack, and people think now also that he was murdered. He was 48. He was in Corsica, and the Sedel officials had the body returned immediately and buried with no autopsy. They said he had a heart attack, but the family suspects that he was murdered. And Ernest Bacchus thinks it may have also been related to what he knew about Banco Ambrosiano.
Now, these are events that took place primarily in the 1980s. I want to note for listeners that the investigation into the, quote, suicide, unquote, of Roberto Calvi has now been reopened, and there is an investigation into his murder taking place, yea, verily, even as we speak. Lucy, veteran listeners to this program are familiar with some of the tortured history, I think might be also appropriate, of the Vatican Bank, the Banco Ambrosiano, the Propaganda Due Lodge, but just by way of historical review for some of our younger listeners, listeners. If you could tell us about Roberto Calvi, Michele Sindona, how they relate to the Propaganda Due Lodge, and also the role of P2 members Calvi and Sindona in advising the Vatican Bank and the role of Vatican Bank in the Ambrosiano collapse, before we move directly back to Clearstream per se.
Well, this was the bank which moved and invested Vatican money, and a lot of the money, one might say laundered a lot of the money. The P2, which included a lot of very powerful people in intelligence, in the church, in business, in Italy, was involved in nefarious activities and was behind a lot of nefarious government activities. One thing's now that they were behind a lot of the things that were blamed on the left in Italy at the time. And Michele Sindona was responsible for the collapse of a bank in the United States, the Franklin National Bank. He, by the way, was an important advisor to the Vatican, and he was also important advisor to mafia figures in Italy. But he got control of the Franklin National Bank in the United States. It collapsed because of his machinations. He was put in jail in the U.S. And then later returned to Italy to put in jail there for his financial crimes. And he one day was given some coffee laced with cyanide, and he died.
That was actually
in his jail cell. So there were people there that figured that he knew a lot, and they didn't want that told. By the way, if people see the movie Godfather 3, based on the book by Mario Puzo, the story of Banco Ambrosiano and the characters around it are the subplot in Godfather 3.
Yeah, I would note that Michele Sindona actually died in prison after having been extradited from the United States to Italy to begin being held to account for some of these many things. The P2 Lodge actually had functioned as something of a crypto-fascist government in Italy, headed up by a man named Licio Gelli, who actually had been an active supporter of Mussolini during World War II. And among the members of the P2 Lodge were Silvio Berlusconi, the current Prime Minister of Italy. Now, you mentioned that Ernest Bacchus, along with Denis Robert, published a book, Revelations, or Revelation, about the Clearstream Network. When that book hit the market, it caused quite a fuss, Lucy. I wonder if you could relate some of the shockwaves that spread out from that, because Ernest has had some pretty interesting adventures since that time in relation to the publication of that book.
The CEO, Andre Lucy, and two or three of his top cohorts were immediately suspended and then fired. And an investigation was started by Luxembourg. There was also some harassment of Ernest Bacchus. Finally, because of the investigation, though, and not very long ago, and the book came out a couple of years ago, Lucy was finally indicted. The other thing that happened, though, which has been quite serious and a difficulty for Ernest Bacchus, is that he and his co-author, Denis Robert, and the publishing house, Les Arènes, were sued by Menetap, or I should say the trustee of the bankrupt Menetap. Now, Menetap is the bank that was started by Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He's the man now in prison in Russia for tax evasion and related crimes. He had started the bank Menetap at the time of the collapse of communism, and he pretty quickly learned about how things operated in the netherworld of banking, and he set up, a non-published account. This was described in the book, along with the descriptions of many other accounts, and as a result, he has been sued and his colleagues by Menetap, which went bankrupt. There's a new Menetap group now, but it's not the Menetap Bank, although, of course, it's the same people. But officially, it went bankrupt, and he's now being sued because what he talked about in the book was the Menetap Bank that went bankrupt, which doesn't exist anymore. And he has been harassed because these people have very deep pockets. Of course, they managed to obtain a lot of money through their the phony loans for shares operations through which they got their huge amounts of Russia's wealth. And he does not have a lot of money, and he is being harassed in at least eight eight or ten places, there have been lawsuits, which he has won as they come through, but it costs a lot of money to fight these lawsuits. And so this is something that people that, in the American press, where they talk about poor Khodorkovsky and he's some kind of a saint, he's quite the opposite of that. And this attack on Ernest Bachus is really vicious.
In the second half of this interview, Lucy, we're going to get into the Khodorkovsky situation and Menatep and what is truly a Byzantine and a very frightening rogues gallery of individuals and institutions. And that's a subject that I would like to explore at much greater length and in much greater depth inside, too, of this interview. I would like to note, though, that Ernest Bachus has endured a lot for being a man of character and courage. And it's, you know, in addition to the expense, there's also, it's a tremendous stress for an individual, particularly when you get to be in middle age, to have to put up with a barrage of litigation like this. It's not an easy thing to endure. So Ernest Bachus is someone that deserves people's support and thanks, because he's walking point into a very important and very distasteful battle. Lucy, in the Hound Dogs article about offshore banking, you mentioned that after the departure of Ernest Bachus and Gérard Soissons from the organization, the issue of unpublished accounts actually began accelerating. Clearstream began to dramatically increase the opening of unpublished accounts. I wonder if you develop that for us at greater length.
Well, as I mentioned before, the ones that had a lot of accounts, which were Citibank and Barclays Bank and the BIL, the Banque Internationale de Luxembourg, but they just started moving accounts to these banks that wanted them, even if it wasn't for a legitimate reason. Plus, according to the rules, they were only supposed to give accounts to banks, not to private companies or commercial no commercial or industrial accounts, but they started giving them to corporate clients. Some of them had their own treasury departments who were the size of banks, but this meant removing them from another level of regulation, because the kinds of regulation there might be through a bank did not come if you were just a company. And big companies were such as Siemens, for example, or Shell Petroleum Group, or the Dutch agricultural multinational Unilever. They had accounts, and even according to the rules of Clearstream, they should not have had accounts. And that is the way it went. So this really, what Bachus suggests is that this was turned in to a system for laundering financial paper. And in fact, there is a case in which we saw how that happened, because I don't know if there's time to talk about it on this broadcast, maybe on the next one, but the Frigates of Taiwan case involves Clearstream, and it also involves the Société Générale, which is a French bank, and they laundered kickbacks when the French sold frigates, warships, to Taiwan in the 90s. They laundered their commissions through Clearstream.
We will be talking about that as well as the Menatep situation at greater length in the second half of this interview, Lucy. If you could, we've got about 5 minutes left in this first side of the interview. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about some of the Colombian customers of the Clearstream network, and also perhaps in that regard, there is an aquatic or marine metaphor that has been raised by some of the people familiar with Clearstream, and it's sort of a pun on the name, and it relates to the Colombians and some of the other customers. I wonder if you develop that for us.
Well, they joke that Clear Stream means the river that washes. Now, in Colombia, Ernest Bachus found some lists of the secret accounts with the numbers, and he compared some of the numbers on the published list and found that in some cases they were the same as numbers on the secret list. So, for example, there was a bank account number 70287. This was on the published list. This belonged to Citibank in Nassau, and the same. And then the number 70292 is of the Banco Internacional de Colombia in Nassau. But on the published list, the numbers both belong to the Banco Internacional de Colombia in Bogota, Colombia, and there's no mention of Citibank there. But if you look at the published list, people may think they're doing business with two banks in Nassau, the Bahamas, and one of them is a subsidiary of Citibank. But actually, if you're sending something to these numbers, it's going to go to the country of the cocaine cartels. And people might like to know that there's that this is a way, obviously, to launder money. So it's made people are made to think whatever institution is sending the money thinks it's ending up in the Bahamas, and it's not. I repeatedly called Citigroup in New York, which owns Citibank, with requests to explain this, and they just over and over denied to talk to me.
Do you know, would money, perhaps this is not something which could be easily fathomed, but would money that had gone to one of those apparently, ostensibly Citibank accounts, would that be then, would that become part of Citibank's overall valuation? Or
I don't really know how it worked or whether it ever really got there or just, I don't know how it worked because the Citibank refuses to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got the documentation, but they refuse to talk about it.
And I think it would be perhaps, correct me if you think I'm a little bit off base, but if one wanted to give a brief functional and practical description of Clearstream, it's an international financial network that constitutes, among other things, one of the major points of interface between the overworld of big business, including some of the commercial brand names that we've become familiar with, some of the corporate names that we've become familiar with, Citibank, Chase, Manhattan, Royal Dutch Shell, and the, quote, underworld of elements that are supposedly dissociated from the overworld, the criminal elements of drug trafficking, international terrorism, and so forth.
Well, it's certainly a way for them to move value, financial paper, and it's financial paper in one way, in one direction, and money in the other to pay for it, to move it in a way that investigators and regulators cannot follow their secret non-published accounts. Why do they need them? Why does Citibank need 271 non-published accounts?
And time permitting, in the second half of the interview, I'd like to discuss some of the implications of this clandestine economic network, and in particular how it impinges on the fates of nations, particularly in the third world. Lucy, we're almost out of time for this side. I wonder if you could tell us briefly about Hound Dogs. This is a new investigative publication that is being birthed, yea, verily, even as we speak. Could you tell us a little bit about that and where listeners can look out?
Yeah, Hound Dogs. Hound Dogs is based in New York. The publisher is Hoshin Seki. That's spelled Hoshin, and then Seki. And the editor is Lucia Moses, Lucia Moses. And the idea is that this is an investigative, hard-edged investigative newspaper. But this issue that I had the cover story on is the first, it's the prototype issue, because Hoshin has to raise money to put out more issues, and if there are people out there who are investors, maybe they could find him and talk about supporting this publication. But the idea is for it to be a biweekly publication. It will be published and distributed first on the East Coast and then move west to various cities so that the advertising in each city will support it.
Okay, listeners can keep their eyes peeled for a website. We've been visiting with investigative journalist Lucy Commissar, and we'll be talking with Lucy and talking more about the Clearstream Network in Side 2 of this broadcast. For Lucy Commissar, this is Dave Emery. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 458, being recorded on May 2nd of 2004. Thanks for listening.